Okay, well, we're starting very promptly because strangely, everybody's here on time. So thank you very much for coming this evening. Welcome to Browser's Bookshop. And it's very special this evening, as you'll already have tasted. But we've got two guests. So we've got Sue Quinn here. He's going to be talking to us about her lovely new book, Coco, which you may already have had a look at. And a bit later on, we're going to be talking to Sally, who is from Pump Street Bakery, and she's going to be telling us more about their chocolate, and we'll be learning how to taste chocolate properly as well. So the format is all going to be a little bit different this time. Is I'm going to be chatting with Sue for about 30 minutes, finding out a little bit about her and the book, and then there's the opportunity to ask some questions if you've got some questions for Sue at that point. Then we'll ask Sally to tell us a little bit about the tasting, so you will have to rein it in for a bit, but lots of questions, and then we'll do the tasting, and then, you know, we can chat a bit more, generally, because I'm sure there's going to be lots to talk about.
Okay. Not Brexit.
Yeah. Oh, chilling. Okay, so, Sue. Can you tell us a little bit about yourself, first of all? Because you're a food writer, a journalist,
yep.
And you've written numerous cookery books.
I have. I'm a journalist by training, so I trained as on day-to-day newspapers in Australia, in Sydney, and then I was posted to the London office 20 years ago plus to be the London correspondent. So I'm a journalist by trade. I didn't want to go home, basically, so I stayed here. And then I had children and did something else, but then came back into writing, not news reporting, by editing cookbooks. I was given an opportunity to edit a cookbook.
Right.
And then I edited another cookbook, and the publisher said, well, you're so obsessed with food and you seem to know quite a lot, why don't you try writing one? And it was a great opportunity because it worked, and I think I'm up to 14. I think it's 14. Yeah. I mean, not all of them are like this. You know, cookbooks work in funny ways. Publishers commission you. They say, I want a book on crackers. So I did literally do a book on making crackers for cheese type of thing.
Crikey.
Or, yeah. Or the last one I did was, you know, roasting tray cooking. But this is more... This is probably the one that is more me and a passion that I have and the kind of book that I like to read.
Yes.
So.
Okay, well, let's come on to Coco in a minute. But then the food passion then. So the editors, publishers had marked you out as a good editor because you liked your food.
Yep.
When did that begin, if you can identify the time when you realised that food was your thing?
Oh, gosh, I think I cooked lasagna for 15 people when I was 10. Mm. I can't say it was any good, but it always seemed to me to be a really good way to spend the time. I loved it. I just loved the kind of the alchemy of putting all these ingredients together and coming up with something delicious, and feeding people is lovely, and it was a practical help, you know, in my house when my mum was on her own. So I think it's something that I've always done and got a lot of pleasure from, and I actually didn't really dream that I would ever be able to make a living out of it, to be honest. It just, you know, in my era, you became a doctor or a vet or a dentist, you know, no one had food writer, you know, as a possibility. It just, thankfully, it evolved. I found my people and they gave me a chance to do it. So, yeah. And the best things happen when you're passionate about it. I think it's not really a job to me.
Yeah. And but editing other people's work to start with, how has that stood you in good stead for actually putting your own books together?
No, absolutely. It was a huge learning curve because you realise when you read recipes and cook from recipes, you don't really realise how much skill goes into it until you try to cook from a dud one, you know, where there's an ingredient missing or the method isn't in a logical way, or you just, you think the person actually, sometimes you wonder whether the person has cooked this recipe, don't you? Sometimes, because it doesn't make sense. So that was really good training. And also how to the different components in cookbooks. Some you know, there's a format which makes some cookbooks a bit predictable. And you see that more when you're editing a cookbook, and the way I was editing, I was in a position to say, well, you know, do we really need a list of kitchen utensils again? You know, I'm sure we've already got our spatulas and our what have you. Can we have another nice photo and that kind of thing? So puts me in good stead for coming up with my own pitch for a book. It was a huge learning curve. Yeah, absolutely. It's hard work editing a book because you just don't want to miss anything. It's, you know, these are people are spending a lot of money buying ingredients and, you know, celebrating with a meal that ultimately your responsibility is to make sure all the ingredients are there and it's going to work and it's going to speak to the person that's writing it. It's really important. Otherwise, you're wasting money and disappointing people, and you don't want to do that. No. You've got a cookbook. It's supposed to be a joyful thing. So
yes, joyful. Mm. There we are. So lead into chocolate straight away.
Yes, exactly.
So how did this particular book come about?
So I was thinking about the kind of, I really wanted to write a cookbook that had a really good story to tell among the recipes, because I think that the best cookbooks these days tell stories. You know, I was talking earlier that, you know, there's an infinite ocean of recipes that we can dive into on the internet if we just want to know how to put a dish together. So cookbooks for me have to be more than an instruction manual about how to put. So I love books. You know, my favourite writers would be kind of Diana Henry or Rachel Roddy or Olya Hercules. They all inform their recipes with some narrative that tells you about the place that recipe was devised or born in, or the culinary history of the place, or even someone's personal journey about how they ate over the years and how a particular recipe evolved. That means more to almost as much to me as the recipe does. So I like to take cookbooks to bed and read them, and you know, and a lot of people don't cook from cookbooks. That's the truth of it. So, so I knew I wanted to write a cookbook with a story, and then I realised that chocolate, which I am madly in love with, is probably the best food story of all, because it crosses millennia. It's evolved from, you know, the ancients, and it's still evolving now. But it's also delicious to eat and to cook with. But it's also, it's politics. If you look at the story that has brought chocolate to where it is today, it's politics, it's science, it's health, it's nutrition, it's gender politics, and it's embedded itself in our culture so much that it now stars in literature and books and paintings. So there's just so much to say about this ingredient that we all seem to be a bit bewitched by, or certainly in the developed world, we're bewitched by it. Sadly, in many of the places that grow cacao, they've not even tasted chocolate. But flavour was the other thing that I wanted to explore. There are lots of chocolate cookbooks out there which involve, you know, chocolate roulades and delicious cakes and that kind of thing. But I didn't think that it really explored the full potential for using chocolate as an ingredient, because it doesn't have to be all sweet stuff. It can be, and that's fabulous, but you can use it in savoury cooking, and chocolate, cocoa or cacao itself actually is very complex in its flavours, and it's only because big chocolate monoliths cover all that up with chocolate and palm oil that we don't really appreciate how glorious cacao actually is. So that was another thing that I wanted to explore in this. So thankfully the publisher said yes please, we like that idea.
So you had the idea, but how has it evolved then? How has your learning process taken you to this point? What's the timescale involved for one thing?
I probably came up with the idea 2.5 years ago, and then you've got to put a proposal together with recipe ideas. And I knew that I wanted to, there are chocolate cakes in here, obviously, but I wanted to add something a little bit different, to explore some different flavour combinations. So that takes a while to develop those recipes. And then I knew that it was a complex subject, but it was only once the proposal had been accepted that I started to have slight anxiety attacks. Because the more you delve into chocolate, the more you realise how much there is to learn and how there are really nerdy people out there Like, no, but Chris, no, well, Chris from Palm Street, he admits he's a complete chocolate geek. Yeah. There are people out there kind of drilling down into the nitty-gritty of the science of chocolate and how to tease out all those flavours that exist in the natural cacao bean without destroying them through the roasting process and adding sugar and in the process of making it palatable. So it was alarming at one point how much I didn't know and how much I had to know. But that, and my family will tell you, at times I just didn't think I could finish it. I mean, it's not, it's not Encyclopedia Britannica, for goodness sake, but it was a challenge to get my head around all the different aspects of chocolate. And, it's just touched the tip of the iceberg, really. There are volumes and stuff that you can go and read, but also to make it accessible, because after all, it was always going to be a cookbook. It's not an academic treatise on... So that was a challenge as well. But so hopefully, it's a good combination of both. Yes. So I did training.
Well, yes.
My husband thinks this is hilarious that I have qualifications in chocolate tasting, but
But what does that involve? What is that?
So there's an organisation called the International Institute of Cacao and Chocolate Tasting, which is has its own international chocolate competition, and it's quite serious. I mean, because these are people's lives, and it's a massive industry. Yeah. The kind of this craft chocolate industry, there is vast knowledge in this organisation, and they do training courses basically. So I did level one and level two. If I would, I'd love to go and do level three, but that involves going to Peru and the origins, and it's very expensive to do that.
Yeah.
And some people will learn how to taste green cacao beans. Mm. So if they're buyers, just like the coffee industry, you need to know what you're buying if you're a chocolate maker. So it is extremely complex. So I did level one and two. Maybe I'll do a bit more. And then I also travel. So I did a lot of traveling in Mexico and Italy and Spain, just because they were book advances don't allow you to just travel the cocoa belt, which I would like to have done. And the cocoa belt is the kind of the 20 degrees north and south of the equator that the cacao can grow. So it would have been fantastic to do that, but it wasn't possible. But Mexico was a real insight, because people still make chocolate there, kind of in the way the Aztecs might have made it. So So it's a little kind of shines a little light onto the history of chocolate. Yeah.
No, I think there was a comment that you wrote somewhere, something like chocolate is a miracle.
Oh.
So can you explain a little bit about how it is a miracle, how it was made, and what it's?
I guess it is a miracle to the extent that is that's not a real one.
It is a real one.
Oh, is it?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
So inside there is
it's still got the beans.
They're dried, I assume. Yeah. So if you cut that open, you have a pod with what they call mucky. There's kind of maybe 30 to 50 seeds, cacao seeds. They're actually seeds, not beans, but we call them beans. And they're covered in this, what they call mucilage, which is a pulp, basically. And if you go to cacao-growing countries, that pulp is used in drinks and dishes. It's absolutely delicious. If you ever have the opportunity to try it, it's kind of like a lychee, lime type of flavour. Mm. And inside that are the seeds. So in a sense, it's a miracle that little purple seed, which actually, if you bite into it, is bitter and disgusting, how that has become a chocolate bar. That kind of is the miracle, although it's not really, because of what we know, archaeologists know that humans were probably eating chocolate as far back as 3,500 BC, and those civilizations ground up a lot of their food. So they would grind chilies and nuts and stuff, and we can only assume that they thought, well, here's a seed, we'll try grinding that too. I assume it was just part of the culinary culture to grind up some of these things. They would have seen monkeys and squirrels eating the seeds out of the cacao pods. A lot of those animals would have spat them out and not eaten them, but someone enterprising in the upper Amazon, a woman, in all likelihood, because women did the food preparation. So I think it's fairly safe to say that women probably discovered how. And if you grind it on these stone slabs, which is what they would have done, eventually you release the fat inside the bean, which is the cocoa butter, and it turns from kind of a gritty substance, a gritty ground up substance, into a paste. And it actually will become quite shiny. And, you know, I met women in Mexico who don't make it very often anymore, but although they do sometimes, but they remember their mother making it. And they would have to grind it until they could see their face in it, until it reflected. Mm-hmm. And it must have taken hours, totally laborious, but it was a, I think I posted it on Instagram, it was a sign of your potential as a wife. If you could make it, you had to be able to make the chocolate effectively. If you were to make a good wife. So it went from there to... and then it was only a drink.
Yes. So when did it become more of the solid?
Well, it didn't become a chocolate bar till the Industrial Revolution. Mm-hmm. So it was only a drink, pretty much only a drink, until the middle of the 19th century, and when more enterprising chocoholics, I guess, invented machineries that could grind the beans fine enough to make it palatable, and then another machine which could squeeze out some of the cocoa butter from the cocoa mass, separate them out, and then by adding in extra cocoa butter to the ground up cocoa mass, you could make a substance that was liquid and pourable enough to pour into bars, into moulds, yeah, to make chocolate bars. So that was kind of 1848 or something. So up until then, it was just a drink. And then it just has it's gradually evolved as technology and appetite, global appetite for it has increased. The refining processes have improved. But in some ways, they haven't changed, because the whole craft chocolate revolution is still using this kind of the same methods, yeah, the grinding methods to kind of... to do the process. It really hasn't changed very much, but it did take the invention of machinery to get the bar. Yeah.
So in your investigation then, and research, so travel, reading about it, interviewing people as well, so you met different people involved in chocolate production, including Pump Street founder. What were the... I mean, you'd already got a passion for the subject, so what were the big surprises for you? What were you astonished to discover in the whole... process.
I've got to completely honest, I realised that I had no idea how chocolate was made, and that's terrible, because I've been writing about food for a long time, and I think we've kind of in recent years become more connected to the food and its provenance, and we know that there are chickens in hideous conditions in batch, you know, but for some reason I was ignorant about chocolate, so I don't think I even knew how it was made when I started out on this journey. That's the truth of it. And I was only going to cacao plantations and going through the process, and then going to visit places like Pump Street or Dormouse or wherever that I really realised the work that went into it. But it's a fermented... I didn't know it was a fermented product. And then, of course, the real shock is kind of the mass-produced chocolate that we buy cheaply at the supermarket is all, you know, a product of some very grim situations in West Africa, and that was a complete surprise to me. Even more shamefully, I didn't really realise that, you know, all those bars of chocolate we buy cheaply are made by people who live under the extreme poverty line, and they're so poor that they have to involve their children so the children don't go to school. It's a terrible situation. So that probably was one of the darker sides that I didn't appreciate when I started, yeah.
But also uncovering people like Pump Street, so the niche producers who are actually looking at developing different flavours and creating a good product. So how did you find other people like that? And is that a burgeoning business?
Yeah, no, absolutely. Well, you can't... If you're researching chocolate, you can't miss kind of this craft revolution that is happening. I mean, most people, kind of the flag is that, oh my God, there's an 8-pound bar of chocolate at the supermarket now. That's how it comes to most people's attention. But that was part of the... Because while there's all this not-so-good stuff happening in West Africa, the other side of that is there's this amazing stuff happening with whatever you want to call it, bean-to-bar makers or craft makers or fine chocolate makers. And it's just so exciting, you can't help but kind of miss it. And it's, I think Chris says that there's about 1,000 from Pump Street reckons there's about 1,000 craft makers in the US and about 30 here. But I think that figure is probably out of date.
Yeah.
That wasn't even so long ago.
Yeah, I was going to say. Yeah. In the last 5 years, it's probably gone from half a dozen to 10 of us to being more like 100 to even 150 in this country.
And being to bar means that... I mean, it's a slightly deceptive term, really, because Cadbury's is bean to bar. They buy their beans and they make it. But bean to bar in the craft chocolate movement means that these are generally small outfits who basically have control of the chocolate making process from bean to the finished bar. So they will buy green beans and then be in complete control of the roasting, the processing, how that's done. Whether the chocolate bar is rested and left to mature for a while and then packaged, that kind of is the bean to bar process. And generally, those makers are buying really fine quality beans. They're not buying rubbish beans from West Africa, which we don't notice that they're rubbish because there's so much sugar in it that you don't even taste the cocoa. And that's partly why they add so much sugar. and the makers care about the provenance of the beans, and it's like wine and olive oil. They talk, chocolate makers now talk of origin and terroir
and
terroir, terroir.
It's
a wine term.
It's a
wine term, and it talks about the kind of the environment that a grape. So why. Wine grown on from grapes on one hillside might taste different to the one across the road. Is the soil conditions or different rainfall? So, chocolate or cacao beans are affected by that. The flavour of them will vary according to the soil and the rainfall and the how much sunshine they get, whether they're in under canopy cover or not. Most importantly, the genetic profile or the variety.
Mm-hmm.
That's why it can change from year to year. You can buy beans from the same farm, from the same trees, and from one year to the next, the flavour can change because of what the season's been like or what the rainfall has been. And that's why people are starting to do vintage chocolate too. So you can buy from 2019 to 2000.
It was a good year. And that's why you'll see on bars kind of their origin. They talk about origin is... a lot of makers use blends, just like a winemaker will use a blend, but they'll talk of the origin as being, from, Peru or a particular plantation in a particular country, because that will have its own flavour profile. And if the chocolate maker has done their job, they'll kind of harness the essence of those particular flavour notes of that particular origin and roasted them and processed them and added whatever else they're adding in such a way as those notes still shine through despite... the processing. So it's really exciting because you're actually tasting chocolate rather than I will eat chocolate oranges till I die probably but it's not the same product and I think we should kind of get out and explore because it's really exciting that the craft chocolate movement or the bean to bar movement.
So you've got this narrative in the book, but you've also got a number of recipes, and you said that there's the savoury as well as the sweet. But how did you decide what to include? What were the criteria for you, and how do they show off the chocolate to the best?
Okay, I mean, I guess what I wanted to explore. So if you want to get geeky about it, like cacao in its natural state, the figures vary, but they talk about being 500-600 aroma molecules in cacao beans, which basically they're the compounds that give something its flavour. and I just thought that given the complexity of cocoa. Why not pair good chocolate where you can taste those different flavour notes with ingredients that work well with them? Mm. So chocolate can have, and we'll probably taste them later, you'll see from the flavour wheel, cacao can have flavour notes ranging from dairy, so it might taste like cream or milk or butter, spicy notes, from Madagascar is well known for its kind of berries and fruity notes. So if you kind of harness those types of flavours into recipes, it kind of you can enhance a dish or give it a bit of contrast, or just be a bit playful with it to use the potential, because I think we miss a trick just putting chocolate into cakes and into sweet stuff. So I just wanted to have a bit of a fun play using the flavour profile of chocolate with interesting ingredients. So there was some debate about how much savoury we would have in the book, because the publisher thought people are not interested in chocolate and fish and, you know, that kind of stuff. It'll just put people off. And we did have a little think about that. I think I was lucky to get away with a chapter. To be honest, they didn't really want to do much more than that. And probably that was right in the end. So there was that chapter. And then I like to work by chapter headings. So, you know, gooey and all that kind of stuff. I kind of did my recipe list according to, I think I did, well, kind of luscious and gooey or something to slice. Just little chocolate descriptions that I felt were chocolatey, and devised some recipes to go with them. So,
right,
yeah.
Okay. And in your travels and in your tasting, did you discover a favourite chocolate?
A favourite maker?
Or a flavour?
Or a type? Oh, gosh. No, that's impossible, because if you go back to what I was saying before about different origins, and I now judge in kind of chocolate competitions as well, they vary too much. I mean, some people flavour, you know, French-style chocolates, which have a lot of cocoa butter, so they kind of melt really well in the mouth, and other people think that is disguising some of the flavours of the cacao beans, so they prefer something that maybe is a little bit grittier and not so dairy milk, but you get more flavour. So I can't honestly say I do. I mean, Palmstreet genuinely is one of my favourite makers in this country. There's another country called a chocolate maker called Original Beans, which I love because they're a particularly ethical company. They plough every bar they sell, they plant or kind of refurbish a cacao tree, which is really important, and they put some of their profits into projects which support sustainability. Because another sad part about the West Africa story is the deforestation, and in order to try to boost their incomes, a lot of cacao farmers are cutting down more trees, including national parks, which is destroying kind of wildlife and leading to some really sustainability problems with some of the kind of animals there. So Original Beans pours some resources into addressing that. So I like that brand for that reason too. But I mean, really, I subscribe to a service called Cocoa Runners, which I'd highly recommend, because it basically collects all these bars from little makers everywhere in the world. And quite often you'll go on there and they're all out of stock, because this company might only make 20, 30, 100 bars, but you have an opportunity to find something from Hawaii or, you know, really interesting bars, and it's really fun just to sit and have a taste comparison, because they're much more different than you. Chocolate is not just chocolate. Chocolate is amazing. So that's the answer to, do I have a favourite chocolate? No. They're all favourite.
And what about different different countries then, and how they produce their chocolate? Can you identify... Would you be able to pick one up and say, oh, that's definitely from Soho?
A good chocolate maker probably would. No, I can't, because I don't pretend to be kind of a chocolate tasting expert. You know, there are certain, like I was saying, there's a French style, which is quite melt in the mouth and creamy. Chocolate made in Papua New Guinea, for example, is very smoky because they use open fires and diesel. I think people are trying to help them out with that one. It has quite a distinctive smoky flavour. And Madagascar is renowned for its, I mean, I'd say I love chocolate from Peru, because it's really acidic and fruity, and it's anyone who hasn't kind of tasted chocolate and detected that little fruity notes in it should try chocolate from Peru, because it has those little kind of spikes of flavour which are really interesting. My husband, who is a galaxy man through and through, tasted a bar, and I can't remember which bar it was, but it was from a company called Dandelion in San Francisco, which is a company that kind of was at the forefront of the craft chocolate revolution in America, and it's a particular company because it's a two-ingredient chocolate company, so it will only use two ingredients, sugar and cacao. It won't even, it counts cocoa butter as a third ingredient, so it will only use cocoa and sugar. And my husband, the Galaxy Man, tasted one of their bars the other day and said that has got to have dried fruit in it because it just tastes like that kind of that, not a fruit and nut bar, but he had that kind of sensation. And he was blown away by it. And that actually is a bit hard to get now, that one, because they really don't make very much of it. But that's the care with which they want you to taste those flavour notes from the cocoa beans. So I can't even remember what the question was now. Was
yes, and talking about it, I just want to be tasting it. So has anybody else got any questions? Yes.
You've been talking about sustainability.
Yeah.
And obviously the dual threat of climate change and deforestation has made people think about that changes need to be done or made on the in terms of the chocolate production process. Yeah. What changes do you think need to be taking place to ensure that it's fair trade and sustainable?
Yeah, it's really difficult. And I asked this question at a conference, you know, a chocolate conference that was quite depressing, chocolate conference really, because it was all talking about this issue. And I said, what can consumers do? Because I guess one knee-jerk reaction might be to, well, I'm not going to buy Cadbury's or what have you. I mean, the issue is the mass-produced stuff. Mm. Let there be no mistake about that. Unfortunately, our nostalgic childhood favourites are the ones that are the problem, unfortunately. I think we have to be more... the conversation has to be happening. A lot of people don't realise that... or don't want to know that, you know, a child has been involved in the manufacture of their Galaxy or their dairy milk or what have you. So I think we have to learn, not just as we did with chickens and what have you. We just have to... Kids have no idea where chocolate comes from, do they? You know, it comes from the shelf. So I think we need to talk more about that. Chocolate companies are coming to... They're pouring enormous amounts of money into projects in West Africa. And I don't think I think it's genuine because the future of the cacao industry is genuinely threatened. There was a piece recently where I think... was Mars, in fact, had agreed by 2025 not to have any, not to use any cacao beans that had involved deforestation. And how, you know, how meaningful that is, how well it will be monitored. But it is, I think it's just worth asking the question, you know, and being aware that there are other chocolates made differently. Because most of the time, these bean to bar makers are paying their farmers 3, 4, 5, 6 times what the big chocolate companies pay the farmers in West Africa. So if you don't want to give up your mass-produced chocolate confectionery, even think about buying some of the artisan bars because you'll be supporting a cacao-grown community somewhere else. It's just a really complicated question. You can't boycott them because that's the livelihood, meagre as it might be. it just has to change. We have to pay more. We have to pay more for chocolate, I think. That's the answer.
Yes. I think
the chocolate
craft movement's quite interesting. Is there any craft chocolate actually made in the places where the chocolate's grown?
Tree to bar. It's a thing called tree to bar chocolate. So instead of bean to bar, where the beans are shipped to the maker, the chocolate is made at origin. And in the Academy of Chocolate competition when I was judging, there's a whole category now of that chocolate, so you have to look out for it. I've gone blank on the names. There are some in the book of the makers, and it's historical that if you think about the kind of the where cacao grows, it's not conducive to making chocolate. It's too hot, and also they're under they're not developed countries, so it's difficult to get the machinery and the electricity and the water and the transport systems to make it financially viable to make chocolate. But it's happening more and more, and it's really something to keep an eye out for, because I really support that, because it means that cocoa growing community is getting more of the financial benefit from our addiction to chocolate, which really they don't otherwise. So it's a really good movement to support if you see it. Cocoa Runners has tree bar makers on their list.
I was struck by something I think you said almost in passing earlier, which is that a lot of the people who actually grow the chocolate have never tasted chocolate. To a culture like ours, where we grew up stuffing ourselves with it from... Is that purely because for them it's a product and they don't see the end product?
They never see the end product. No, they never see the end product. They and it's part of the problem with throughout its history there has always been this chasm between the very poor people who harvest and grow the cacao and the comparatively very wealthy people who consume it. And that's because of the geographical divide and the socioeconomic divide as well. And it just means that they have no idea, a lot of people have no idea what chocolate is, and it's terrible in this day and age, isn't it, to think that part of the problem in making good chocolate in West Africa is that the farmers have no connection to the product. Yeah. So they're not particularly invested in looking after their trees or making sure they don't have disease or what have you, because it doesn't mean anything. The end result doesn't mean anything to them. It was interesting because at the Academy, this conference I was talking about earlier, that was reasonably depressing, talking about the state of the sustainability problems. They had a competition between chocolate makers to see if they could devise a way of making chocolate in situ, where on the plantations, they were very crude, but at least some way of producing a basic chocolate bar so that farmers could actually get an idea of what chocolate actually was.
Yeah.
That's how far removed from the process they are. So you kind of had these, some of them were great, little kind of gritty little blocks. They're probably very much like they were back in the 17th century when chocolate first came to the UK and was ground up to make a drink. That's probably a little bit what it tastes like, but it's a step. It's a step in the right direction, but it is quite sobering, isn't it, to think that we just kind of scoff it cheaply. And
we are obsessed with it, but also it's been advertised quite prominently. I mean, it's a very commercial product, and you've got, through the book, you've got images of old posters of chocolate.
Mm-hmm.
So how did you decide to include those, and how have you looked at the commercial promotion of chocolate?
Well, I guess I have to ask my designer about.
Oh, right. Okay.
I mean, I certainly wanted ones that that basically dotted throughout, I guess, illustrated some punctuation points, I guess, in the evolution of chocolate. Mm. So obviously, a lot of them are for drinks. And some of them kind of say, you know, eat more milk is Cadbury's dairy milk thing. So that's kind of the message. And that has been, and it still is, because the glass and a half symbol is still on the Cadbury thing. This thing that, especially in the early 20th century or the kind of early 20th century, chocolate was marketed as a health food. And certainly when it first arrived in the UK in the kind of the middle of the 17th century, it tasted disgusting. It didn't have sugar added, it was bitter, it was gritty. When you put it with water, the fat all rose to the top. So it was actually, why anybody wanted to drink it, I actually no idea. But it needed a bit of propaganda to get it going. So there was a lot of marketing and pamphlets going around touting chocolate as curing everything from, you know, a loss of libido through to your stomach problems and what have you. And, you know, we're still seeing that, aren't we? A square of dark chocolate cures cancer and all sorts of malarkey, aren't we? So it's always been associated with health. So I guess we wanted to choose some images. I mean, women, get me onto that subject, women in advertising and chocolate. That's been it. Well, it's just always been a key theme, hasn't it? I mean, Cadbury's invented the mixed selection or the dairy box, and then from that point, well, I mean, it goes back a lot further, but I think that was the start of chocolate being used as a way for men to try to seduce women. You know, a box of chocolates would win, you know, that was enough to win you over.
Only if you came through the window. That's been a bit of evidence.
I mean, that, interestingly, that ad, what's the catch line from that?
That's
recently been revived. So we think we're making some progress, and then actually the ladies are still there, aren't they? You know, being swept away. All it takes is a box of chocolates. And that's interesting, isn't it? Because there's, you know, one theory is that chocolate is ladies' food, you know, that women are particularly hardwired to like chocolate. something about the hormones or something, that we reach for chocolate when we've got, you know, our period, or we're heartbroken, we reach for the chocolate and stuff. And I think it's just a marketing, you know. It's been successful, though, I think.
Right, okay. A couple more questions at this time, and then we'll move on to the tasting, or is that the wrong thing to say? Because we'll move on to the tasting.
The tasting.
Yeah, okay, right. So, tasting. Sally, you're on. Okay. Right, okay. Got a taste. Give me a minute, and I'll get some sheets, and I'll get some chocolate, and we'll get going. Okay.
And there's a nice history of
Pump
Street in the book as well.
There is a nice little history of Pump Street in there.
Yeah, of course. So to start you off, I think. What was interesting, I think, about what Sue was talking about earlier was the nuances of taste and flavours in the chocolate, and how we all imagine the chocolate tastes like sugar, and that we're all familiar with this kind of confectionery taste. And what I want to try and do with you today is to get you to start thinking about some of the flavours within chocolate that don't necessarily come to mind when you immediately think of chocolate. And I'm going to give you a chocolate now, which I'm not going to tell you what it is just yet. If you can take this and hold on to it until we come back to it. Yeah. Until we've all got a piece and we'll eat it together. I assume you disagree with me now, because I think that there is no hard and fast rules about tasting.
No, definitely. I definitely agree.
I'm definitely a chewer, not a sucker. Thank you. Because I like to think of tasting chocolate in three different sort of steps, really. The first thing I'm going to do is just look at it. Look at it, look what it looks like, is it shiny, what does it smell like, what does it... Smell is such an important sense within chocolate tasting, as is just the pleasure of looking at chocolate. Is it shiny? What we're eating now are collets that we make for chefs, so they might not be as shiny as we'd like them to be because they get bashed around a little bit, but... a beautiful tempered piece of chocolate would be so shiny, as you were talking about, you can see its face in it, glorious. So start with just looking and smelling and thinking about getting your taste buds going.
They're going.
Good. And then what we're going to do is I'm going to take a piece. Maybe you can break these in half and eat them half at half. When we eat one, and then we can talk about it in the second half. Nice. I chew, and I like to understand, I like to think about what I'm tasting instantly. The texture of the chocolate, is it smooth, is it gritty, is it buttery, is it dry, all of those sort of textures, thank you, those textures to start with. And then once I chew, I get the instant hit of chocolate. What am I tasting? What are the first things that I'm tasting? And then as the chocolate melts within your mouth, you probably will go on a bit of a journey with the flavours. If you're eating good chocolate, you should be able to trace one or two, three things. And then what I'm left with at the end, and again, good chocolate should stay with you. You should have a nice clean palate and a nice strong taste of chocolate which stay with you. So let's try this. Let's have half of it. Eat, chew, however you want. If you want to suck it. Are you going? You've done it. Mm. You were way ahead of me.
I started.
Fruity. Mm. Instantly fruity. Mm. Everybody getting fruit?
Yes.
Mm. It's a Madagascan chocolate. There's some, oh, we're going to look at our fruit wheels too. Sorry. So this wheel, it's just a help, really. It's just an aid. And basically, what the wheel will do is it'll give you a map of where you can start tasting. So if you're looking at fruity, a few people said fruity, you can go from the centre and work outwards. So if you look at fruity, and then you start thinking about what sort of fruits. Is it tropical fruits? Is it berries? Is it... what else have we got on there?
Citrusy
things, yeah. And then once you've started to identify that, then you've got to think about what kind of berries they are, if you're thinking berries, or what kind of tropical fruit. And then it's...
Cherry.
Mm. Yeah, I get cherry too. I'm going for the second piece of fruit. Just to make sure. It's quite warm in here, so it's quite soft, but not necessarily snappy.
What did you call
these?
The chocolate discs, what did you call
them? We call them pastilles.
Pastilles.
Colettes, pastilles, drops.
That's the word you said.
Yeah. Colettes actually is a trademark, pastilles. So, do people like it?
Yeah.
I don't get nuts in that one. Do you get nuts?
No, maybe a little. No, fix. Not for me. Fix. Maybe something like that. And also, we won't taste necessarily taste the same thing. Maybe as an instant to start with, here is quite a smokiness at the beginning. It's quite a chocolatey chocolate. You get a real hit of chocolate first, and then it bursts into those berries later on.
It does sound
fresh. Yeah, there's berries. You don't think, and then it just suddenly comes. Yeah.
I find it quite earthy.
Earthy, yeah. Okay. It does have a really strong hit of chocolate in the beginning, which is quite earthy and soily.
Is the tannic or anything like that? Because my teeth are all feeling sort of
dry.
Good.
Do you want to ask that when I get the next or red wine?
Yeah. There's lots and lots of tannin in chocolate, and so it's like wine. The skill of the chocolate maker is to balance the processing or balance the roasting or what have you, so that there's a good balance of tannins and other flavours.
Okay.
So you finish on that kind of like. If you drink an over brewed tea.
That's
kind of the tannin. Which put all of them in.
I thought there was a Jamaica one.
There is.
So that's a Madagascan that we've just tried. This is a Grenada. This chocolate comes from a very small farm up in the north of the island called the Crayfish Bay Farm, which is run as a real cooperative in that. The money that comes back to that we pay the farmers goes directly to the workers, and they decide what they're going to do with it. There's a percentage that comes up just to run the farm, and then after that goes back to the farmers, who then decide how they're going to spend the money, whether they're going to invest back into the farm or whether they're going to take it as bonuses, depending on what kind of year they've had. So it's really, again, it's that idea of sort of sustainability, because these farmers are local workers, obviously they want to invest in their farms, and so it's really nice for us to be able to do that. And also they make great chocolate. And also they are one of the tree to bar makers too. They're starting to make their own chocolate on site, so from the same beans. But we are the only people to have these particular beans from this farm. So, try. Can I ask you to pass it along?
Is it an absolute travesty then to have coffee with your chocolate?
It will spoil the flavours, and undoubtedly it will affect the way that you taste the chocolate. Whenever we do tastings at work, we'll always make sure we do it in the middle of the morning after everybody's rinsed their mouths out and make sure nobody's had coffee too early, because it will make a big difference, and anything you eat will make a difference to how you taste chocolate. Definitely.
And chocolate judging, they give you little pots of soft polenta.
Chris keeps trying to get us to eat polenta. We've never quite met. Polenta sticks to the water. We're not judging, we're just saying whether we like it or not. It's always worked for us.
See, I love polenta, and by the time I get the next chocolate, I've eaten the whole bowl of it.
Oh, really? No, I can't do that. So, the same thing again, really. And also, the other thing that might be interesting. to think about when you're tasting chocolate is the smell. We talked about smelling chocolate and how important it is, the smell. And often if you, we were talking about holding your nose, if you hold your nose and you eat your chocolate and then let your nose go halfway through, it brings the flavour up into your olfactory senses and you get a real hit of chocolate too, so that's kind of quite a fun thing to do. So try it again. So this is Grenada, let me know what you think. What?
Mm-hmm. We have got some Jamaican.
Yeah, I thought we had. That was
I'm going to do good. I ate too much chocolate. I'm going to make my
Yeah, just rip it. It's fine. Yeah, it's fine. You just rip the top. Yeah.
No.
Musty.
Musty.
It's very different.
Oh, wow.
Bitter?
It's also sweet. It's a strawberry flavour.
Sweeter? And a little at the end, it's like, yeah.
Strawberry. Mm. Definitely strawberry.
It's funny, this chocolate. It ages. It makes a big difference, aging this chocolate. At the beginning, when you first taste this after it's been ground, it tastes really lemony. And it loses that quite a lot. I'm not getting a lot of the lemon from that.
I wrote lime, mint, red fruit, musky.
Yeah, pretty good. Pretty good. Do you want the job?
That first flavour.
Mm.
That's kind of almost like a...
In the same place.
Coffee?
No. Like a dairy or a sour, like a yogurt or something. Like something slightly off.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah? At the beginning and then it and then that smooths out, no?
I don't get that. It might be that this, you know, we were talking again about vintages, and this particular farm, the chocolate that we got was very different from year on year.
Mm-hmm.
And I think this is a 2018 chocolate, but 2017 was really very different.
Mm-hmm.
And they had a lot of issues, a lot of difficult weather in the Caribbean mm-hmm. late last year, so mm-hmm. I think that obviously had made the difference to the chocolate.
The finish is so different to the. You know,
that's
the initial taste.
Yeah. Yeah. I was about to say that. It's got a kind of the taste that I'm left with is something right at the back of my mouth, which is quite soily or tobacco or smoky or. Yeah. Nice full body bread.
So where's that on your chart?
Well, it's wherever you want it to be. That's the point. You can do. I'm just putting it. And you do, there isn't one place for it either. That's the thing about these taste wheels. You can put crosses all over it, and then it's quite interesting when you start trying one Madagascan against another Madagascan, and then you can start comparing what the flavours.
A Grenada.
This was a Grenada. Yeah, Grenada, 70%. The first was a 72%. The Madagascar was a 72.
I'm sorry.
Is that part of your creation?
Yes, it's simply that, actually. Now we try to do that. It might be that we are looking for something within a particular percentage range. For instance, we were making Honduras 80% bar. The beans are no longer available, and so we've got a slight gap in that sort of 80% range for us. We've got a 70, 72, 70, and then it goes up to 85 and 100%, we even do 100% bar. So at the moment we are looking for a really high percentage. It might be 80, it might be 90, I don't know. It'll be determined by A, the beans, and what works in terms of the roast profile and what we just think is the best profile for it.
So you experiment.
So we experiment, and you
experiment flavors.
Exactly that. And you experiment by doing the process right through to the end, to the bar. And then, of course, you've got to let the bar age. So we can make a bar and we can try it. But then we always age our chocolate because it makes such a difference in the flavouring of chocolate.
And one of the reasons why, I mean, you are still a small maker, even though you're a hugely successful small maker. Mm. The amount you make is tiny.
Yeah.
But one of the advantages of small makers and the reasons they can produce such really interesting, good quality bars is they can afford to, they're in a position to experiment because they're using small grinding machines. So they can make a small batch, give it a go, and there's no huge loss if it doesn't work. Yeah. But if it does work, it might be amazing. Whereas someone who's using I don't know, what are the big, huge tons of it in each bag. They can't do that, and consistency is what they're striving for anyway. So.
And we're looking for differences, that's what we're doing. And also, we make very limited addition bars because we haven't got enough beans to make a lot of bars. So we've made, as you said earlier, they make 100, 200 bars sometimes because that's all the beans that we've got.
Can I ask a really daft question? No. I'm really sorry, it's coming as a consumer who has not been educated about chocolate. Mm-hmm. If a 100% bar, is that the term?
Yeah.
Healthier.
Well, it hasn't got any sugar in it.
So it is just the lack of sugar.
Yeah.
Okay.
So yeah, in that terms it is, yeah. Okay. I struggle with 100%.
Yeah, sorry.
I try to be converted. I do struggle. There are one or two on the market that I really like. Again, I think it's the Madagascan, the ones that are slightly fruitier, have that natural fruit. So we do an Ecuador, which is a really earthy chocolate, and for me, I struggle with it. Lots of people really love it, and it's one of our best-selling bars, funnily enough. Yeah.
The thing to bear in mind with 100%, well, with chocolate anyway, is that but the percentage...
Yes.
Relates to the total amount of cocoa bean that's in it,
right.
Including butter.
Cocoa butter.
So one producer might put a lot more cocoa butter, as you know, compared to the cocoa mass to another one, which is why some 100% will melt easily and just taste creamy, but probably that does cover up some of the flavour. So some of them are more palatable, aren't they, than others.
Thank you.
So this is Chris Brennan, who is the founder of Pont Street and the guru of all things chocolate and fermented, is from Jamaica. And we've been looking for a Jamaican bean for quite some time, and we finally found somebody who was allowed to trade directly with us, because everything we do is direct trade, and it's the first time somebody's been able to do direct trade from their cocoa plantations in Jamaica. And so we made this, and we had no idea what we were going to get, really, and then when we ate it, eat and see what you think.
Smooth. Pretty strong honey.
Almost like mead. We always thought it was slightly meady. Mm-hmm. And or maybe like alcohol.
Yeah.
Like rum.
Rum and raisin.
I was waiting for somebody who said that's what it is. Yeah. It's rum and raisin.
There's raisin there, isn't
there? Yeah. Completely different.
Yeah. But we couldn't believe it when, you know, it seemed a silly thing that we bought Jamaican beans and got rum and raisin chocolate.
Why is there an issue with it being direct or not?
It's just government control. So it was all sold through a third party. But now we've been able to drill direct. Mm. And of course, a lot of the farmers that we're dealing with now, we just phone them or we Skype them, so we can see what they're doing, which is obviously something we haven't been able to do before. So we can talk to farmers and they can literally show us the beans on the trees and show us how they're fermenting. And because what the farmers are doing too is the most important process in the process of chocolate making. Without good beans, you can't make good chocolate. Mm. And so what they're doing, 70% of the work is already done by the time it comes to us, 78% of the work. And because if they're not fermenting and drying their beans really well, which again is one of the problems in sort of West Africa, and people who don't understand what the importance of the beans, the quality of the beans has on the end product, who don't care so much about the care of the beans while they're making, that's why that's an issue for, again, because they're not worried about looking after the trees or the beans or how they're harvesting or stockpiling beans so that you get beans, different beans from different strains of beans, different origins, all being stockpiled together, fermenting at different rates. Which is no good for us. Mm. You're never going to get a good chocolate. Mm.
Has there been a discernible improvement in the farming that you've noticed by virtue of the fact that you're paying more to farmers and more people buying beans directly?
What's happened, I think, or what's starting to happen, because more and more craft chocolate makers are looking for smaller farms or direct trade and looking for single origin, but single estate. So we're looking for one farm so that we know that the beans that we're getting are from one farm. That means that farmer can have a more sustainable business because we're paying way above the normal prices for cacao. So that is so definitely.
And presumably others are going into the market because they see the
potential. Yeah, potentially. I think that we have heard, we've had stories from people coming over asking us about, we've got this cocoa farm, we don't really know what to do, we've never really used it as a business before, but now that there are makers who are looking for good beans, it becomes a more sustainable business for them. Definitely, yeah.
Can I just ask, what's your own background? How did you get into chocolate?
Mine's completely different, that story altogether. Yeah, I'm very new to chocolate, just sort of 5-6 years ago. I came and it's been a very steep learning curve. I have a theatre background.
But you know what, this is the story of chocolate. You know, there are people in the chocolate making industry, you know, like Duffy Sheeran, ex Formula One racing engineer.
Who makes amazing chocolate.
The famously, you know, applies the same strategic mentality to shaving seconds off lap times.
That's his
kind of thing. But it's really interesting how many different walks of life are changing career to make chocolate.
Let's make this the last one then. Is everybody okay with bread? Eating bread? Nobody has allergies to bread? Wheat or anything? No? Okay, fine. Then take one, pass it.
What is the time frame from the sod on the tree to, I don't know if I'm asking the question correctly, to the bar?
From tree to bar? Once the beans come into us, we can make a bar, we can sort it, roast it, make the chocolate.
And you age it.
That takes about a week, I guess, to sort, roast, and actually grind the chocolate, conch the chocolate. Yeah. It takes a week. But then we age chocolate for at least a month.
And where do you store it?
In a fridge. Well, you know, the temperature controlled storage unit, actually, outside the back of it. We keep everything at about 16 degrees.
It's about a month and a half.
So about a month and a half, but it doesn't really work like that because it's never. But if we were to just take one bean and try and make a bar out of that, that's how long it would take. We could then make chocolate out of it. In about 6 weeks, 7-5, something like that. Yeah. So what you've just been given now, just as the last one, is I don't know if anybody knows the history of Punt Street, but we were a bakery, and we are a bakery. We still are a bakery. The bakery still bakes every morning. I'm going to take some. Yeah, I'm going to take one because it's my favourite. So the sourdough, and what's interesting, I think, is that the reason that we moved on to making chocolate was because of the fermentation process. And the fermentation process in sourdough making, the early stages of letting it grow and the bacteria grow, mirrors exactly the fermentation process at the beginning of chocolate, almost exactly.
And that story is actually in the book.
Mm. Oh, is it?
I've done that story in the book of how.
So that's why we started making chocolate, because it was the fermentation process that we wanted to start playing with. So then we thought, how do we put the two together? So we took our bread and we dehydrated it and ground it into crumb, and then we grind the crumb into the chocolate whilst we're making it. This is an Ecuador chocolate, so it's quite an earthy chocolate, quite caramel tones to it. And with the sourdough ground in, and then add crumb added as well, you get chocolate on toast. Chocolate spread on toast.
I could make myself sick on that one.
I haven't had any chocolate today because I knew it was coming here. Actually, that's not true. So, I can talk all night, but I'm sure...
Very good. Well, we do have to call an end to the formal part of the meeting, but I'm sure you can just stay and mingle and try a little bit more. The recipe is there. So the shortbread and the popcorn are both in the book.
Mm-hmm.
So do try those if you haven't tried them already. And I think that's about it, really. You can have the book signed, obviously, before you go. Mm-hmm. And you can chat to Sue and Sally a bit more. But we really need to thank Sue, because she's had a terrible journey to get here.
Oh, no, that's right.
It took hours and hours. So
it was my pleasure. It's such a lovely bookshop. Thank you.
Well, it's been really lovely. So thank you very much.